Welcome to the Enduring Curiosity Podcast. I am your host, Greg Outer. Join us as we seek solutions to the challenges facing our world today. Through curiosity, we can forge a resilient future for all life on this planet. The Enduring Curiosity Podcast is a production of Lucasfilms Media in partnership with Enduring Curiosity, the Citycraft Foundation, and Solutions Journal. For our first episode, I'm thrilled to welcome John Knott to the podcast. John Knott is an internationally recognized leader in urban regeneration and sustainability, and the creator of the Citycraft process that restores the economic, environmental, and social health of cities. Welcome, Mr. Knott.
Thank you.
So let's get started with what is Citycraft?
My philosophy is grounded in this idea of healing the garden, which is about healing our relationship with each other and healing our relationship with God's creation, which in that combination, we will actually create a healed world. And we believe that real estate and development are the most important professions that affect that, because we effectively are the ones that touch every one of these systems and control what causes the impact on those systems.
Historically, we have seen development, we've seen real estate, we've seen the way cities and states manage that as a way to divide or control or disadvantage certain populations. But through your work and through the work of a lot of others, we've seen how that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. What are some ways that you personally and others in your field are working to reverse some of those negative decisions of the past and create a more equitable and sustainable and regenerative human ecosystem?
I think a lot of our problems actually come from, it isn't just the issue of equity from the standpoint of who gets the wealth and how we divide that out. I think a lot of it has to do with, a lot of things have changed in the last 50 or 60 years in certain areas. In some areas, there's the same old story for the last 400 years. But it's always been the other. There's always been someone that's been oppressed or someone that's been kept out. As wealth is created in general classes, there's a tendency, once you get to that level of wealth or institutions get to a certain scale, we tend to calcify, and it's all about protecting that wealth and the institution. So that hasn't changed either. That continues to be an ongoing human crisis that we all hopefully try and find some balance in. I think that the way I was raised in business as well as in a family, we were always taught that the health of the community we were in across the larger area was in our direct economic interest. And so if the system was not healthy as a whole, it was our vested interest to actually help heal that. So our family has a huge legacy of being involved, not just in the restoration of Baltimore, but support of hospitals and orphanages and all kinds of nonprofit areas historically. I think that we have evolved. The things that have changed recently in the last 50 or 60 years really has its catalyzation as we've started to build these national and global systems and these large-scale organizational systems. And what that has done is really aggregate too much wealth and too much power and too much control in too few hands. And so when I was growing up, we had in Baltimore City and the state of Maryland, there was no such thing as cross-state border banking. But over time, I think starting in the 70s, we started to move in that direction and break that down. So in Baltimore, when Baltimore City is being revitalized and you created the Baltimore, the Inner Harbor Project, you had lots of national important businesses, but the controlling decision makers were there. Every city had those people there, and the money in that state and that city stayed in that city. In that state. and were reinvested there. So you had savings and loans organizations, you had commercial banks, you had trust banks, and all those organizations and the heads of those organizations pretty much knew each other. They knew the city and they knew the issues, and they became the leaders to solve problems and work together with the public sector. I'm not saying everything was perfect, but we had control of our resources at that time and could redirect those. That could never be replicated again, not in the city of Baltimore or any other city, unless you might be a Chicago or a San Francisco or an LA or a New York, where you had all the national or international companies are aggregated. But today, for instance, in consumer deposits, we're looking at what, six institutions that control 72% of the capital, and none of that capital is controlled or decided about in local settings. And so the people who are making those decisions are making decisions in places they don't know and people they don't know. So that's creating a huge problem with allocation of resources and too much of that resource being controlled at one point. The second point I would make is that we have been so hell-bent on focusing on efficiency. We have efficiently removed the value from everything. And if you look at the Suez Canal fiasco right now, one ship, 4 football fields long, wider than the Suez Canal itself by a significant amount, gets off kilter and throws the global supply chain into a mess. Now, what all this efficiency focus has done is create a way in which we've basically thought only about short-term efficiency, only about short-term cost, and we've externalized all other associated costs, which are not included on the cost formula of any of those companies. They still can make their profit without paying any of that cost. So a lot of the damage that we're doing around the world in, I haven't really said this before, but I've thought a lot about it in the last 6 months. We talk here in this country about the evolution of slavery, and we talk about the great sin of this country. All our externalization of our manufacturing and externalization of many of the products that are no longer allowed to be distributed in this country, like baby formula and things, are all being externalized to other places. And we essentially are creating paid slaves at very low wages in the rest of the world, which is creating all kinds of other impact. And our businesses are operating in less than safe environmental standards, which would not also be allowed in this country. And we're externalizing all that cost. So we're creating a huge impact across the globe. And our consumers and most of us don't even know that's going on. And so a lot of the issue here is about awareness, and a lot of the issue is about diversity of control and ownership and getting more focused on our bioregions that allow us to build to a much more equitable scale. And I think where there's too much scale, there's too much anonymity. When there's less anonymity, there's more awareness and there's more accountability.
So that segues perfectly into what I'd love to talk to you about is the community-based, the local-based kind of contextual approach to addressing the specific needs and challenges of communities. We see in some places it's food access, some places it's having public spaces, open spaces, it's pollution in others. It's some places that just simply are built to look like a prison just through bad architecture, bad planning. And in others, it's the inefficiency of transportation and the removal of the pedestrian from the transportation space. What, in your experience, is the benefit of focusing in the localized mindset for developing cities, and how can we use our local stakeholders to help guide us in that process?
First, I would say that our community-based process is about fundamentally grounded in the idea that the wisdom of the community that's being impacted is equal to or more important than the wisdom of the technical capacity of our experts. That doesn't mean we don't have wisdom and we don't have knowledge, but the people in the local community and area are very well grounded and understand, because they live it every day. They know what they don't like. They have a pretty good understanding of what they don't like. Reasonably good understanding with proper questioning about what they value and what they do like. And they have a good sense of what's missing And some of what's missing has actually been removed, you know, historically from that area, whether it's a grocery store, whether it's a transportation system like trolley cars or, you know, rail systems, or whether it's a hospital or whether it's a police station, a library, closing of schools. And all of this kind of harks back to a time prior to this focus on efficiency. Carnegie set up, I think, 2,200 community-based libraries across the United States. Fun, beautiful forms of architecture, and they were in small towns and neighborhoods that really provided access to knowledge and access to information that these communities never had, because there was no such thing as a library system. You had the Enoch Pratt Free Library System created in Baltimore City, which now created access to those and a very robust set of neighborhood library systems. I experienced that as a citizen and child growing up in Baltimore City. The amount of local branches of libraries that have been closed to aggregate to larger spaces is stunning. And it's in a very short period of time. And we did it because of efficiency, because this entire idea that we could, if we aggregate everything into bigger schools and less schools, the bigger libraries, thereby less libraries, we have efficiency. You have less staff, you have less executives. And we did the same thing. We've gone from footprints in grocery store, neighborhood grocery stores that might have been 2,000 square feet to 10,000 square feet. Now we're up to 80,000 square feet. And you wonder why people can't, grocery stores don't want to locate in certain areas like North Charleston, because it doesn't have enough traffic or enough income produced. Well, when you build those kind of stores, you have to have a massive amount of income and a massive amount of people coming, which then directly impacts transportation systems and movement and accessibility. So I think it's a lot of this is also driven by this efficiency idea. But if you study the history of our cities in this country, they grew from the core and they grew from the edge incrementally. They did not jump these huge leaps we've been doing for the last 50 or 60 years coming out of World War II. And so I think that our community-based ideas, it's both by regional based and both community based. Within the community based system, we're saying that there is a need to address things at system scale, because we do not believe you can affect change in any system unless you can get to the beginning of the food chain in that system. So, for instance, you don't have to address the entire school district, but you do have to address a K through 12 feeder system, not just one school. The justice system is the same way. The ecology is the same way, because you have to understand the watershed you're in, not just the stream you're next to. And so a lot of our work, and I'm going to read you something, the conclusion from our urban redevelopment textbook that we launched or published in August 2019 with Routledge Press. It says, fundamental to our understanding is that if you do not count a person, an ecosystem, or an existing physical asset or organization, you have assumed no value and no need for consideration. At the heart of the Citycraft mindset is a process that ensures that we make every effort to count and value all human, natural, financial, and existing physical capital assets in our community. This discovered access and underutilized capacity, which forms the foundation for the Citycraft platform, is nothing more than counting and valuing all that we have discarded and pushed aside. It is this foundation that creates the new economic capacity for our future regenerative economy. And so we sit in a bioregion, and we have a community in which we're part of within that bioregion. The health and safety of our social community, our brothers and sisters, is directly related to the health and safety and capacity for growth or getting better of our ecosystem and our economic system. They're all interconnected. You can't make these decisions on national scales, because people don't know each other. And the only groups that can operate effectively on a national scale or an international scale are organizations who are controlled very much at the top with a very linear and very top-down organizational system. And what that then dictates is that anybody else who is underneath that scale at a lower scale has no control over the decisions. And that means very few people are influenced that decision matrix. And we think that is fundamentally at the cause and destruction of the complete collapse of the social metrics in this country over the last 30 years. And we don't say that there shouldn't be national or international firms. We believe that we've always had international trade throughout the world, but it's only in the last 50 or 60 years that we took control away from all of our local communities, our cities, and our states. It has been completely removed, and they have no influence at all.
So it sounds like cities, the way we approach them, the way we approach the systems that surround them and our human ecosystems, they need to evolve, not just to survive the effects of climate change, but to survive the other challenges, whether those are social inequality or economic inequality or any of the other major stressors that they may experience. What are some areas that we can create short-term change as individuals, as neighborhoods, as communities? And what are some ways that we can start looking ahead and making longer-term decisions?
Well, the first short-term decision we need to make is we need to start counting everything. You know, our inventory and communication process is all about at the system scale level. So like whether it's in West Denver or areas we've looked like at in, say, Calgary, Canada, or Baltimore City, or Charleston, South Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, any of these cities that we've looked at or regions, what we are finding is that there's numerous organizations in these system scale areas underneath the bioregion, thousands of nonprofit organizations that exist, all mostly marginally operating, very few cooperating with each other, many don't know each other. And if they were wired together in a community relationship network that started supporting each other, we're finding that you can actually, by going through that inventory process, with them doing the inventory themselves under this process, they're starting to discover all kinds of capacity. The second thing that we've seen a lot of is that if you look at the way cities are budgeted and planning is done, and you know, the whole idea that we actually inventory all of our existing roads, buildings, you know, police departments, substations, fire department, and actually make that part of the capital equation. But that goes on in the British system of managing cities and towns, which came out of England originally. You see it all over Canada. I mean, they know exactly what the value of all their assets are. Every single one of them, all the utilities, every building, they actually know what the depreciation value is, what the replacement cost is, and they assess this on an annual basis. And so we need to get our hands around all these assets that actually exist. We say in housing, only 1% of housing is created new a year. Well, I can assure you that in the whole public sector world, it's probably even less than that, dramatically less than that. And so if we're not counting all these assets, we have no idea the economic value of all the renovation, improvement, and changes that need to be made. And if we knew that, we'd actually be able to inventory all the human capital that we have in that region and build a whole economic system around those people who are not employed, that are homeless, that are immigrants or refugees or people that are underemployed, and create an entire economic system to deal with that at the local level. You know, why are we going through a process where we're bidding everything out to all these national regional firms and not supply networks where, but by region, we could rebuild our economies basically just on looking at that alone, along with a much more effective transportation system. If you look at the evolution of our cities over time, you know, we built an entire streetcar network in city after city after city around this country, which evolved from the core to the edge and created an entire robust network of transportation and walkability that was brilliant. And what did we do after World War II? We tore the whole system up. We, city by city, and I won't go into the details of this, but there was a strategy to actually close all that system down, build roads so we could incentivize the manufacture of automobiles and make the automobile the primary form of transportation, that then started pushing all of our cities bigger and bigger, roads bigger and bigger, people further and further apart, which then multiplied the amount of infrastructure we had to build to serve those cities and dramatically reduced the density per acre or per square mile of our cities, which dramatically increased our public sector budgets to try and cover those areas. So it's a combination of things that we can do locally. And most of the information is at hand. Most of the knowledge is there. It's just we're not counting. And we don't have a strategy to do that. And that Citycraft has built the platforms to do that over the years and has, you know, figured this out. And I shouldn't say figured out. We've developed the process, and the figuring out is actually by using the process, the community and the leadership there figures it out themselves, because they are the best ones, because each solution, there's no such thing as an exact same solution in each fire region. It doesn't apply. You need to come up with the metrics that are important for that particular region and the skill sets that are needed for that region.
So let's kind of dive in on a particular bioregion. So the East Coast, specifically the Southeast, seemed to be particularly under threat to rising sea levels, to climate change. The cities along the coast and just inland of the coast are having to reevaluate where people live, whether or not they continue to honor federal flood subsidies, whether they prioritize certain forms of infrastructure or others to manage water, to manage storm surge, and to manage the other upcoming problems. How would you begin to approach a city like Charleston, South Carolina, which is right on the water, that has been connected to the water for generations, but is under a very real threat from being overwhelmed by that water?
So the biggest issue we have in the Southeast from a climate change standpoint, other than the pollution effects of all this carbon and health impacts, is effectively water. And it's either the reduction of water. So our ground source systems are really under threat for available consumable water. And that's because we've been extracting all this water out of our aquifers. That then has then, if you go to Florida and you hear about all the sinkholes and you hear about all the sinkholes across many cities and states, what you're looking is a direct impact of removing water from that those aquifers that then deplete the water from that ground infrastructure. And then the collapse of that infrastructure, the natural infrastructure, is happening as a primary result of that. The second thing that is going on is the increase in water from sea level, rainstorms, et cetera. That is dramatically exacerbated because in response, I'm going to say it's to malaria and mosquitoes and lots of other things in the pandemic of 1918, there's a huge redirection of the way we dealt with infrastructure and building new infrastructure, which is very important for stormwater and sewage and water systems. And what we did was cover up a huge amount of many-year linear parks throughout, like the city of Charleston and other areas, are basically closed down stream beds. And so what we really have to do is depipe those areas. The second thing we've done is massively remove trees and just... You know, the water carrying capacity of an 80-year-old tree is unbelievable, and it's even a dead tree, you know, that has died and still staying there in the forest. The entire root system, in many cases connected to other, has all kinds of life around it. And as we take all this stuff out, we're dramatically reducing the stormwater carrying capacity of the area. So I would say that our first step from an ecological standpoint is that we have to map and understand our natural systems and how they existed and where they were prior to human settlement destroying them and taking them up. And what we have learned across the United States is that you can basically reconnect and reestablish about 60 to 70% of those systems in most cases, unless you're dealing with a city like Manhattan, which is deeply developed, I mean, just everywhere, you can reconnect a lot of those systems. And the second thing we have to do is then start really making a huge investment that's way less than the damage that's being caused by climate change. An entire forestry system program, both urban and suburban and exurban. And we have to understand that, as an example, in Baltimore City, 120 years ago or more, when the original water system was built, the city itself, which is an incorporated city, is not part of the county itself, which surrounds Baltimore, bought Lock Raven Reservoir, which is in Baltimore County, bought much of the forest system to protect that reservoir and that watershed, built a system to bring that water into the city, and built the pump systems to do that. They had the wisdom to know that they needed to protect that watershed. And trees were the things that protected it. 120 years ago, this is not like Native American heritage, even though they knew how to do it. We actually understood that. And today, we have no clue. We're not making those kind of decisions. We're just ignoring what we know that is lost wisdom that we just need to bring back. And it was a practical decision. It was not an impractical decision. It wasn't about knowing, and that same watershed and that same water system is supporting a city that has, I forget how many more people than it had back 120 years ago. Yes, Baltimore has declined from 1 million down to 600,000 or 700,000 people. That million arrived in the 60s and 70s, not 120 years ago. And so I think that's one of the fundamental things that we have. If we're going to get to climate change, we need to really get to that point. And then we have to decide on our land planning how we're now going to protect and enhance all that as we go forward. Montgomery County, Maryland, where I lived for a number of years, had a fascinating planning system through the National Park, Capital Park system. But like, if you bought a piece of land to develop that was 40 acres, and 10 acres of that land was along, they had mapped all their watersheds on all their stream valleys. If you had a property that bordered and included that land, they would allow you to take the density that was on that forest area and that adjacent land of, say, 10 acres was the adjacent land. If you had a 10 unit to the acre or 5 unit to the acre development zoning right, you could transfer from that 10 acres to your residual 30 acres, that density. You didn't lose it. But you had to contribute and keep that land as a buffer to that stream. Now what has happened, you've gotten much more density on the land you had before. You have a park system that's connected all over the county by trails and everything else, and beautiful watersheds and places for the kids to run. And many times in that county, they would actually put the ball fields in the land around the watershed, because when it rains, by the way, you don't play baseball or football for the most part. Now, football, I guess they try to, but they're using land that's actually not development land to put public assets like that in. And so you're not competing with a private sector or taking resources from the private sector. So you've addressed economic competition, you've addressed watershed protection, you've maintained the forest, you're creating parkland right next to your development, so you're driving higher economic value for that developer. And the developer's infrastructure is actually less now. They're covering less area and having more houses per mile or per block than they had before. These are all doable solutions, and there's thousands of them that make very good sense. And we're caught up in politics and caught up in these narrow-minded arguments, which actually make no sense at all. And what we're doing is destroying the basic environment that we rely on. And this idea that the environment and economics is at war is crazy. Economics is a social science. We as a human being are a social organism and a biologic organism. We can't survive as a biologic organism without the benefits from nature, period.
What I keep hearing from you is the answers are there. You know, the knowledge is there. The wisdom is there. We just have to be aware enough to recognize it. And we have to be willing to accept that those answers are there for us to use if we choose to.
Yeah, and this is in my graduate course that I teach at University of Denver and CityCraft. The first book I start with that they have to read is Brunelleschi's Dome, which is the dome in Florence. And if you look at one of the questions I ask them as we go through the book, is how many professions did Brunelleschi represent that we would hire as individual professions today in designing or building a building? And it's like 22. So he was the safety engineer. He was the structural engineer. He was the architect. He was the safety inspector. He was logistics guy. And the guy was a jewel maker. He's a watchmaker, not an architect or engineer. And the brilliance of that book, and in many ways the story, is that a watchmaker in those days with these very complex systems to make a watch work, you know, your pocket watches and all the gears and interface and systems, and you had to have a systems mind to actually make that work. He transferred that systems mind to the built environment. And as a watchmaker, if he was going to sell any valuable watches, they had to be pretty beautiful in terms of design and long-term functioning. And he transferred that to the built environment. And to this day, the span of that dome unsupported, the scale of that has yet to be replicated by all our computers, all our engineers. We have not been able to replicate that. And yet he was able to do it. And so there's an old saying, if you don't know your history, you're destined to repeat it. We have just, in the last 50 or 60 years, we have just like said, and it may, well, it's actually getting up to 80 years, because 46, that's 54, and 20, for 75 years. For 75 years since World War II, we have basically said, man, we've got all this technology. We're so bloody smart. We've got air conditioning, and we've got cars, and we've got telecommunications and electrification of buildings. We don't have to worry about any of this stuff. We can just ignore everything, because we can engineer and design our way out of any problem that's there, and we can actually engineer a way to compete with nature and control it. And the pandemic opened that book and said, that is not true. It has failed. And so if we go back to studying, even back to Roman times, and study the way infrastructure designed, study the way cities were evolved, study the way civic art was a major part of the way cities were built, we can have beautiful cities, we can have economically balanced cities, we can have environmentally sensitive cities. And I'm not saying all the stuff was right even back in the Roman times, because up until currently, in the environment in many cases has been ignored, you know, for, as part of the system. But that started the change with the advent of Burnham and Olmsted and people like Rachel Carson on the environmental impacts of our decision making on a human and natural health. All of that, we've evolved over the last 100 years and understanding the critical importance of the environmental system to our human health and to the health of the planet. So I think we've got a real shot at doing this right. We have to teach regenerative thinking, and we have to teach a regenerative learning process and decision-making process. And that's, CityCraft has committed a significant amount of my time to that in the last 10 years. So we really believe that we need to have many, many more regenerative thinkers and leaders, and also that are community-based. Don't fall into the trap of now becoming the regenerative expert. Because again, the wisdom's in the community, the wisdom's in the place itself, and the wisdom's in the history in many cases, is that we need to recover and then make decisions with the community in balance, so that we're informing how the social community should be organized and how any decision we make economically about what should be placed in that local area or large-scale regional area in the context of the health of the bioregion itself. If we have a water-depleted area, we don't put water-consuming assets as investment assets in that area. If we have lots of human resources available, we should be developing approaches to use those human resources as part of the economic system so that they have good-paying jobs, good productivity, and contribute to the health of the region itself. So I think that and we need to get back to growing our food more locally and creating the urban farming system and the production of our food and processing that food within the defined region, not just produce it here and then ship it across the world and bring it back.
Well, Burnham is credited with saying, make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood and probably themselves will not be realized. It sounds like we need to make some big plans. We need some big ideas, and we need them quickly. Do you see those coming from anywhere? Are you seeing anything out there that you think, okay, this is something we need to do?
You see a lot of them. It's just that you have a lot of people shooting things down. Okay. There are more people shooting things down than there are that are producing those things. But I mean, that's been a lifelong problem. But it is particularly a problem now because the control of our system is in so few hands and the access to the capital is so few to build these dreams. But you do have people like amazing architects and designers like Bob Birkenbaum and Harry Gordon done a lot of our work in the last 30 or 40 years. Those individuals and their firms have done amazing work over the years to really lead us into a new future about how we design. Those were two of the six people that really moved aggressively in AIA, the creation of the LEED system and approach to green building, and also the creation of the Living Building Standard, which actually came out of Bob Birkenbaum's firm. And I've worked on a lot of these things myself because I was one of the early developers that was working in this area. And just because of knowing them, and I've learned enormous amounts from them. I believe very strongly that vision and passion do attract resources, and rarely do the resources attract vision and passion. And that I think that the big idea of the response to Citycraft in general is really positive in the communities that we go to, because we're thinking at a larger scale and we're getting people involved in the decision-making process, not as charrettes, but as part of, as if they were intimate to the planning, urban planning and development process itself, and gathering the information, being part of the scientific teams, figuring all this out, giving them, you know, decision influence and control. I think that people do want to have an imprint on their environment. I think a lot of the ideas that around food systems and urban food systems that we've been very much involved in, as we've started to get in some of these neighborhoods and areas, and I shouldn't say neighborhoods, but these system scale areas, we're seeing an amazing response by multiple organizations who didn't originally work together, that come together and actually connect themselves and their disparate organizations in various locations to create a large scale food system from producing the resource to consuming it, and every business in between that really get excited about that idea. And we see tons of immigrants and people living in lower income communities who get dramatically excited about the idea of producing their own food and creating small scale restaurants. We call them restaurants, but I mean, food trucks are restaurants, but small scale areas that can actually produce an income for them and bring the cultural heritage of their food into the mainstreams. And I mean, you have people like Mimi Silverberg, who created the Delancey Street Foundation in San Francisco. It's the most successful alternative sentencing prison reentry program in the United States by far. And she did it out of whole cloth. But she did it based on valuing the people who were in that situation and used them as the teacher. You know, each one teaches one. So the expertise and the people who run that organization, which we replicated one of their sites. I never forget the guy, forget Mike's last name right now, but they found out about what we were doing, and they had a meeting at the Harbor Club, and I met this guy, and it was only after the third meeting. I mean, I thought he was a nonprofit executive and, you know, really smart, and he certainly had graduate degrees and all. Guy was a former felon, had a very interesting background, and it was, you know, she deeply believed that it wasn't her that was going to solve this problem, and the expertise resided in the human beings themselves. And just because by the grace of God they got caught and I didn't, she brought them back into the system because she valued them as human beings and their skills and ability to be productive in our society. There's a lot of good ideas on the social side. There's lots of good ideas on the environmental ecological restoration. You have guys like Storm Cunningham, who wrote the book The Restoration Economy, and Paul Hawken, who really launched a huge movement with Blessed Unrest. There's lots of people writing, and there's lots of people acting that have really big ideas. And We've been fortunate to get to know a lot of those people, and they have become part of our own work and our network over the years. So I don't think there's a shortage. I think what there is a problem fundamentally with who's in control, and that the control of the system has gotten to such a large scale, and the control of the capital that needs to be accessed is such a large scale that it's become a real impediment. So for instance, money is a big part of this problem. And some of the highest wealth in this country is controlled by pension funds, municipal and union pension funds, and state pension funds. Now, all the money that goes into those pension funds comes from the employees that are working within the municipality or the state. And yet, because the advisory services that they employ to advise them where to invest, they're generally being told that they shouldn't reinvest that money in their local community where that money came from, because that doesn't meet, quote, fiduciary standards and have too much Alex. So their money's moving all over the world. Well, why does that work? Well, it works real great for the intermediaries and for all the brokers, because they get fees up and down the system for doing that. But the idea that you can't invest the money in the same place where you got it from to recycle that capital into that region and create less costly ways to bond finance your public buildings, less costly ways to make access to capital to restore areas and invest in business in those areas. They're investing in pension funds, they're investing in businesses, enterprises all over the world. Why don't they just do it mostly in their own community? I mean, they're going to know the people. The people are going to know them. They're going to have a lot better shot at assessing character. And they're also going to have a pretty good idea of whether this thing's going to work or not. And so it's this whole idea of efficiency and scale and massive systems that are controlling are at the core of the problem we have to address.
So regeneration, regenerative design, regenerative systems thinking are a core element to your work, to CityCraft, to the entire idea of how we need to go about solving a lot of the issues that are facing our communities, our world, the natural world, the human world. How do you define regenerative thinking, and what are some models that we could look to better understand that?
The example I use a lot to get people to understand regeneration. Regenerative means the capacity to create more life, more abundance. A great example is an oak tree. And the oak tree drops thousands, if not tens of thousands of acorns into the soil that it has been part of creating through its own life cycle decay system and rebirth every year. And that one tree every year is creating more and more capacity year after year after year. That's what regenerative thinking is about. It's not less is more. It's not less bad. It's about creating a healthier system in the bioregion we're in that enhances the health of the economic system, the health of the environmental system that we depend on, and the health of the social order. The idea that the natural landscape and the land itself and the ecology is the frame. So you map that ecological system pre-human settlement, and you let that inspire where and what you do. And I think a really great example of that in an affordable housing situation, in an entry-level housing situation, is the Oak Terrace Preserve community in North Charleston, where you had essentially an abandoned or close to abandoned World War II temporary housing site that was built by the Navy for with essentially portable mobile housing at the time, not mobile, but manufactured structures sitting on piers with no foundation, wood water lines. The areas being closed down, it was a very, very dangerous area, 50% vacancy, had all kinds of every imaginable type of house and every not ill-conceived, but problematic element of a society you could find there. And you had all kinds of pollution. The state was going to shut it down because of the water lines breaking and all this, the storm, the sewer lines and everything. And across the street, you also had a closed gas station that had all kinds of environmental contamination issues. But at the same time, that same 55-acre site had 900-plus trees on it. I mean, centuries old and massive, massive trees. So we started with the trees and did an inventory of those trees from A through F and decided to keep everything. I think it was A through E. It was either A through E or A through D, to keep all the trees. We then studied the watershed itself and what the carrying capacity was or wasn't. It was very little carrying capacity in that area other than the trees itself. And we figured out how to just let the land and the water systems and the trees actually drive our land planning. And so we literally, what would be looked at as a new urbanism site, design style really was grounded in the ecology of that place and maintaining those trees in place and designing it, that site, to carry a 2-inch storm event right on the site itself. And that was accomplished by using permeable surface alleys, distributing your infrastructure in the alleys. And because the permeable surface was actually bricks that could be pulled out, you could access that infrastructure without tearing up roads and just relay them. You had rain gardens and constructed wetlands on every lot. And the land plan of the built housing was dictated by the trees. And we got the zoning approved so that the houses would move back and forth, not line up like soldiers, based on the tree location. And so when you drive down these streets, it looks like this place has been there 100 years. But before we developed the land and we knew what we were going to remove and alter, we literally pruned the tree roots and the trees themselves and stabilized them for a year before we did anything to allow the trees themselves to stay healthy. And so a lot of times when you're developing, you destroy a lot of trees. They call it the law of unintended consequences, but it really isn't that. It's really, we didn't even ask the question of, are these trees going to actually live if we tear up the root system? Because we don't even know that there's a root system that's alive and well way beyond the tree itself. And so each tree at that scale, I forget the amount of water it can hold within an individual tree. It's massive. So the stormwater carrying capacity of that site was never reduced. It was actually dramatically increased. And then we got approval to tear this gas station down, remediate, and turn that site into a constructed wetland, which then the water from those rainwater systems and overflow would feed into that constructed wetland, which treated the site. And that, when that was built and launched in, it was like 2006, 2007, when the first houses were being built. Might have been a little later than that, a little earlier, I'm not sure. You're talking about $139,000 entry-level price in the 2000s. For a pretty nice townhouse and single-family houses that were, I'm trying to remember now, I think the townhouse, the single-family started about 180 or something like that. I mean, it was, and it's been a very, very successful community, but it's that type of planning and that type of thinking that can allow us to really recover our neighborhoods, build new neighborhoods. But again, we're building in the context of an existing city and area. We're not like leapfrogging and going someplace else. And so every decision we make, so for instance, there are decisions that we've been part of, as an example, on a building that was in an inner city area. 40% of the employment from that community came from the neighborhoods. And this is back in the 1980s. We use those jobs as a way to enhance the economic order of that community and provide more of the resources that came out of that building to go into the community. But at the same time, we were using that as a way to train people to do construction work. I mean, one of the huge problems in this country is access to human beings that have artistry and have the skills to do this, all the different things that we create in the built environment. And one of the most significant areas of growth in the construction industry is ecosystem restoration and corrective work to rebuild our natural systems, stormwater carrying capacity, and essentially we can depipe even from stormwater piping a lot of our cities to actually use nature to actually carry that stormwater and manage it. And believe me, it's a hell of a lot cheaper once it's done than to tear up a concrete pipe and replace it. And we're creating multiple benefits from that. Nobody ever went to a stormwater drain to celebrate a birthday, but they certainly go to a stream bed, you know, with an adjacent parkland to actually have parties and eat out and join each other and go through nature and learn all kinds of things. Can't learn much from a stormwater pipe. And all of those different benefits accrue. So I think that a regenerative mindset thinks of every element of the system that they're part of. You know, if you're creating a building, you need people to build that building. Those people are employed. Can those people, if you're in an economically depressed area, can those people come from that community itself? Can we make decisions, like I believe in, like we've talked about low income and affordable housing. If there's any form of housing that needs to be stronger, more durable, and healthier than any housing we build, it's low income housing. And yet, the worst stuff we build with the least durability and the least longevity and the highest replacement maintenance costs and materials that tend to be more toxic than a lot of other places is affordable housing. Now that's some of that toxicity thing has changed dramatically across the entire built environment, but it is, you know, instead of asking the question, why don't we have affordable housing or what causes the affordable housing problem? We keep asking the question, how do we build it cheaper so people can afford more? Well, the problem is where we put this housing as an example, if there's no transportation system and there's no access to food or other services that they need, what do they have to do? They got to get in a bus or have a car. And a lot of people in this country, including middle-class families, historically have been spending more on cars and insurance for those cars than they have on mortgages or rent on their homes. And operating costs in these communities of buildings because they're energy inefficient and aren't well-maintained are outrageously high. So there's all kinds of components to, and that's why you have to think as a system. You can't think about affordability as just the materials of a building or how much less labor you use to produce that building. You have to think in terms of all the pieces you're connected to.
So one of the first things I'd love to expand upon in your answer is the idea that whether it's affordable housing or it's other civic structures, it seems like we're not really building things to last anymore. Why is that? And how do we get back to that?
It's two reasons, efficiency and short term. You know, we're thinking about what it costs to build something now versus what it costs to maintain and operate that building over the next 30 years. And in a 30-year period, 90% of the cost is going to be in its operating life. And many times in our public sector, it's starting to change. And even private, you know, large-scale organizations that are NGOs or are in the even in the private sector have had historically a separation between their operating budget and their capital budget. So the idea that you'd actually spend more money in your capital budget to reduce your operating budget is like illegal, particularly in the public sector. And so because of this whole focus on short term and bidding out everything and designing everything to the lowest cost, we have effectively just forgotten everything. And the only thing that's governing our decision-making is how do we make it cheaper? And as a result of that, we've created a built environment that looks ugly, is uninspiring, doesn't last, costs too much to operate, and essentially is unsustainable because many of the times we then just tear it down and build something else. And if you look at how the efficiency model that we've gotten into, for instance, on retail, and hotels. I mean, drive down the highway and stop at a Holiday Inn, or put a blindfold on, drive down, arrive, you know, go to Calgary, go to South Carolina, go to Alabama, go to Montana. You'd have no idea where you were, because that model is, because of efficiency, is built in and created so that everything's the same and over and over and over again. And it has no relation to the climate, no relation to the bioregion, no relationship to prevailing winds, no relationship to storm issues. And we wonder why we have so much destruction. And I think that to me is, again, the fundamental driving point. And if you look at schools, look at the schools that were built before 1940. Look at the schools that were built, and even some today, but more readily look at the schools that were built from, say, 1960 to 1980 or 90. Schools that were built prior were on public, main public roads. They were civic art. They're gorgeous. They're built with very durable materials, have tremendous capacity to be reused, not only as schools or as housing or any number of other things, office buildings. The schools we built in that 40-year period have very minimal adaptive reuse, have very low value in terms of their durability and capacity, and the design of them is such that nobody really wants them anyway. It's a mindset shift. This is the beauty of all this is it's a mindset shift, which we talk about a lot. And that's what we teach, to how to create that shift. And the other part of this that's so beautiful is that we shifted 60 or 70 years ago, politically, governance, and budget and management across the sector. So essentially, we designed the outcome that we're getting. And to some, it was predictable. To many others, it wasn't. It was a law of unintended consequences, a lot of people like to say. But we designed it that way, which means we're fully capable of designing a different way. So the inspiration to me is we're in control of this situation. This is not out of our control, because the problem was created by us, not by anything else. It was created by us, and we have the capacity to change it.
So it looks like we're winding down a little bit here on time. So I'd love to just close by asking, what are you working on now, or what's next for you? What has you excited about the next part of your work, or CityCraft, or something like that?
I'm excited about two things. One, I'm excited about, I now have, I don't know, 50 or 60 students that have graduated from a graduate program at the University of Denver, phenomenal regenerative thinkers all across the engineering, architecture, development, real estate, but also public education, social work, all kinds of different disciplines that are thinking that way. Their energy, their passion for this is unending. I'm excited about the young leadership we have at Kat Rodriguez, who's running our CityCraft Foundation, and Annie and Mike, who are running CityCraft now into the future. I mean, I see myself as really being, I'm around. I see myself, I call it being behind, not in front. But it's really to use my time to write and to teach and to act as a mentor in many ways, and still be present in our decision-making, but as opposed to being in the role of decision-maker and running everything, I see myself as really using what I've learned over all these years to get behind a whole new generation of people and to create way more regenerative thinkers than we have today. That's what I'm excited about. And I think I'm also really excited about the new energy around CityCraft and CityCraft Community Partners, which is really trying to drive this new focus on governance and the new focus on regenerative capital systems. And I think we're starting to see progress in those areas. And I think there's, what I'm seeing is I've stepped back. I've stepped into a different role, not stepped back, I think is probably the way to say it. But I think that everything that I've learned allows me to know where the many mistakes are. I'm able to look at situations that the younger leaders are looking at in CityCraft and give them the wisdom of all the mistakes I made and what I've learned having made those mistakes. But I do think that I'm not going to say I'm excited about the pandemic, but what I really am excited about is that what the pandemic has revealed. And I think the pandemic has finally revealed to people that we're pretty screwed up and that a lot has got to change. We cannot go forward after this without making enormous changes. And I think it really, it's a whole, but the potential for a mindset shift has never been better. And the potential to really get people to understand how important nature is as to us as a species and as a community, and they, how important what we call our, what's the term we're using in pandemic, our not most important, our essential workers. Well, if there are all these people are essential workers, and it seems like they should be paid if they're essential workers, and they should be protected if they're essential workers, because we've certainly seen what happens when they aren't. And I think it's maybe a new day in terms of the way we look at the economics of our system, shortchanging all those people because of efficiency purposes and lower cost the first time, so that the cost that we're now, I think if people knew that we were going to spend $5 trillion already on trying to respond to this craziness, and we're going to be spending a lot more than that, they could actually figure out that if we've done a few other things differently over the last 20 or 30 years, by valuing those essential workers and compensating them properly and organizing our systems better, we wouldn't be spending all this money. So I'm very excited with that revelation portends for us in the future.
Well, I share your excitement in that, and I'm thrilled to see what happens next with CityCraft Foundation, with the communities you're partnering with, and how we can continue to learn from that work and from the writing that you and the other members of CityCraft are doing on Solutions Journal on the blog there. Just always fascinating insights. Thank you so much, John, for being here and for sharing all this wisdom with us today.
Thank you, Gray. And I think I should have said the thing I'm even as much excited about is a young person like you who's got this amazing vision for your documentary production company in terms of creating these documentaries around the wisdom of Aboriginal and local communities all around the world that prove that people who are local actually have the answers for us and have living examples. So, and congratulations on all the work you're doing.
Thank you, John, for joining us, and thank you to each of you who tuned in for the first episode of Enduring Curiosity. Curiosity is the greatest gift from our childhood and the key to solving the world's most pressing problems. Join us again in 2 weeks as we continue our conversations with thought leaders, innovators, and storytellers working to transform our world. Until then, my name is Greg Outer. See you next time.